KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a film screening of COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. COINTELPRO 101 is a one-hour documentary produced by the Freedom Archives explaining an illegal FBI program coined as the Counterintelligence Program, spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, that targeted revolutionaries of the 60s and 70s. There will also be a presentation of ongoing local work and Q&A session after the film. Again, that's COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
It's a good old song called "I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground." Sometimes you ain't what you think you want to be, but dadgummit, be satisfied, because you ain't what you don't want to be, and if you ain't what you don't want to be, you don't want to be something you ain't. That's good English for you, boy. This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial or KBOO.fm. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer. The Old Mole is a collectively produced radio zine of the commie pinko egghead persuasion about politics, history, economics, society, and the interdependence of life. Every Monday morning, we offer interviews, commentary, reviews, poetry, and music to agitate, educate, and inoculate you so you can organize your thoughts, as well as maybe your workplace or community. You can always listen to the show again online within a few days of the broadcast by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab a little ways down the page. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter to get updates on recently posted and upcoming shows, or write us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to get on our mailing list. That's also a good way to pass along comments, suggestions, questions, or to learn more about becoming part of what we do. Today's show starts with Bill Resnick and Al Bradbury, a former KBOO Labor Radio host who now works for Labor Notes. They talk about how Labor Notes is putting the movement back in the labor movement and survey some of the newer struggles and timeless tactics that Labor Notes covers. We even hear a labor parody that Al Bradbury wrote and performed of the ultra-popular Beyoncé song Single Ladies. Bookmole Larry Bolden reviews Intrusions by Ursula Heggie, a novel within a novel about one woman's confrontation with her conflicted identity as an artist and a mother. And to wrap up the show, I talk with Cassie Thornton, an artist visiting from the Bay Area, about using art for resisting debt. Now we turn to Bill Resnick and Al Bradbury.
Al Bradbury, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Bill.
KBOO listeners, surely labor radio listeners, will recall Al Bradbury. She was a stalwart programmer for the Labor Radio Collective for several years. At that time, Al was a researcher and organizer for Portland's Service Employees International Union, Local 49. She wrote a good deal at that time, including music lyrics. In fact, we'll be playing one of her great hits later in the show. She left the SEIU to work at the monthly journal Labor Notes, where she has written innumerable articles and has become, in fact, the editor. And she was back in the Pacific Northwest last week. She was in Seattle, where the talk of the town and many in the labor community was the kayakers, the blockade of a huge Shell oil drilling rig. It's anchored in the Seattle port, but it's being ready to be moved to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean. The blockaders are trying to stop it. After Seattle, she came down to Portland to work and be a troubadour at the very successful Labor Notes Troublemaker School this last Saturday. Al Bradbury, you talked to Seattle Labor about Blockadia, about the struggle, talked to some longshore workers, many other workers. How is labor in Seattle responding to the blockade?
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly labor has tremendous mixed feelings as a group, I would say, about the situation. And I just in the course of meeting with people about organizing a Seattle Troublemaker School, I talked with people from a number of unions who were thinking about or their union is taking a stand against the drilling. People talking about how important it is for labor to not simply stand for all jobs, any jobs, even when they're going to destroy our whole planet. There's a coalition of labor coming together, I think, to be a sort of labor against the drilling coalition. But also when you talk with longshore workers, for instance, who are doing those jobs, loading the oil rig in the terminal and will be loading and unloading the boats that service the oil rig once it's up and running, if it does get up and running. The people I talked to said, look, Arctic drilling isn't our favorite thing, but we really need those jobs. And certainly it is true that the context of the port there, the consolidation of the shipping industry has meant that port jobs are threatened. Ports are sort of being pitted against one another, winners and losers, and you sort of have, is Seattle going to lose out to Tacoma? So I think port workers are anxious, and an employer, one of the marine shippers, just left the port, which is why there's this open terminal there.
For them, Shell could be a bonanza in jobs, and so many longshore workers are now being furloughed and find themselves having to try and get a job as a barista.
Certainly, and as Seattle housing development booms, as the condos spring up everywhere, that waterfront land that's now a terminal, I think there's very real fear that that'll turn into housing developments. That they'll, you know, that'll be sold off, and that longshore jobs would sort of permanently be gone from that section of the waterfront. Which is not to say that we should go ahead and drill in the Arctic, but what it left me thinking of was the narrow choices that labor is boxed into. That sort of where we're told that it's either the jobs or the environment, and we've got to be able to think beyond that and to build a movement that includes a demand for good work for longshore workers and of course for all workers as a key part of our environmental movement.
Right. And in fact Labor Notes has covered that a good deal. The Railroad Workers United have really led the way in many ways for labor environmentalists. Why don't you tell us that story?
Yeah, Railroad Workers United, if people don't know, is this wonderful, scrappy little cross-union caucus.
Cross-union caucus, all the railroad unions.
Right, yeah, and there's, you know...
Not the unions, these...
Right, rank and filers. Right. Rank and filers from within the engineers union and the conductors union, or well... It's a little more complicated than that, but there's a union that is largely engineers and a union that's largely conductors. And the two unions have sort of, at the top, allowed themselves to be pitted against each other, I would say. And as the size, the number of people in the cab of the train has dwindled from 7 to 5 to 3, you know, many trains now have 2 people in the cab, the engineer and the conductor. And there's a big threat on the horizon that they might be down to 1 person in the cab of a train. And you think of that oil train that exploded in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, a couple of years ago. There was only 1 person in the cab of that train. He had parked it on a grade and left for the night. Nobody knows exactly what went wrong. All of these people were killed. And the knee-jerk response is always, well, blame the worker. He must have done something wrong. But railroad workers say, well, if we had had 2 people in the cab of the train, perhaps there, you know, sometimes it takes 2 people to break it correctly. Sometimes somebody catches an error.
Let's talk about Railroad Workers United, though, and the job struggle.
Yes.
And their proposals.
Yes, well, and the environmental connection I wanted to make is that they just had a joint labor environmental conference, both in the Bay Area and in Olympia this spring, to bring railroad workers and environmentalists together to teach each other, you know, labor 101 for environmentalists and environmentalism 101 for railroad workers, to begin the conversation of saying, look, we clearly have some adversaries in common, we have some interests in common, we have some things that we don't understand about each other or that we fear about each other's agendas. Like, let's begin by understanding and start to work towards building a common movement, a shared movement against these companies that are running the coal and oil trains really are hurting the communities around the trains and the people who work on the trains. And it is possible to fight them together. But But it takes, you know, starting with understanding. We have to make sure that when we say green jobs, that that's not just something we're tagging on to the end of a list, that we're really sort of fighting seriously and have a plan that's persuasive to people who need a job now and tomorrow for how people might transition from the spot that they're in now to a livelihood that's better for the planet and that values the skills and years of work that people have. It's sort of not just there will be more jobs, but like there will be a path for you into those jobs.
Another part of that, though, is guarantees of decent work for people who are able to work and want to work. It seems to me that one of the things that keeps workers in a relatively passive position and they look apathetic. Actually, there's a lot of anger and a lot of recognition of that things are turning against them in the most unjust ways. Everybody's competing with one another. It seems to me that one of the great struggles now is to win a guaranteed income for people and guaranteed jobs. If that were to take place, your average person would be freed to, in fact, operate according to their real needs and desires rather than the effort to satisfy the employer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a ways in the future, but there are struggles.
Yeah, well, and certainly it's been exciting to see people making much bolder demands in the last couple of years than they had before on, for instance, what should the minimum wage be? You know, my colleague Mark Brenner, who came to labor through the living wage movement, talks about how many years of sort of cautious struggle being in living wage campaign meetings where you said, well, we're going to try and get $7.50. We can try and get $7.75 this year. You know, is another quarter feasible?
Can we get it indexed?
right, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I think something that's been wonderful to see about the movement that fast food workers have touched off, that the campaigns in Seattle have launched, and now we've got Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, that 15 is a much more exciting demand because it really does come closer to what it would take to live than these sort of incremental gains. And people are inspired by a vision, something that offers a really different vision of what life could be like than just a tiny improvement here and a tiny improvement there. So I do think it's a good moment for us to be not just saying, well, what do we think we can win this year in the most pragmatic sense, but what kind of world would we like to live in? And let's talk to people about that.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking to Al Bradbury, who once a labor radio stalwart. She now works for the monthly journal Labor Notes. Al not only writes and edits, he's the editor of Labor Notes now. She's also a musician and, in fact, played at the Labor Notes School and the Jobs with Justice annual meeting. People had an opportunity to hear a good part of her repertory. Al, we're going to play one of your songs right now, and then we'll be back in a minute to discuss Labor Notes and new labor and the kinds of struggles that are needed and likely will, in fact, come to fruition to revive the labor movement, that's to put the movement back into the labor movement. Stay tuned. After the music, we'll be back with Al Bradbury.
All the union gents.
All the union ladies.
All the union gents.
All the union ladies.
All the union gents.
All the union ladies.
All the union gents. Now put your fists up.
Down on the job, we're getting robbed. Somebody's getting rich off us. Asking for a raise for months and days. The boss says, what's the fuss? Do I need to mention we got no pension? Let's get that evil man's attention. We cried these tears for too many years. Time to get organized. So if the boss is on your back, you better listen now. If your job is on your back, you better listen now. If your contract puts you left, you better listen now. Cause if you wanna win, I'm gonna show you how.
Solidarity.
Al Bradbury, lots of folks are pessimistic about the fate of the labor movement now. The membership is declining. There are tremendous attacks from conservatives and lots of Democrats on the labor movement, particularly public workers in states like Wisconsin and Indiana. And they're also passing right-to-slave labor laws, known as right-to-work laws, in quotes. That's their definition. It really is rights-to-work-for-less laws or... And the problems of organizing unions. It's very, very difficult to organize a union if the employer decides to hire an anti-labor union law firm and publicists and the whole apparatus. They'll go to the wall and spend a huge amounts of money on these consultants and pay some of the fines in order to keep a labor movement union out of their establishment. How is Labor Notes responding? How are you responding to this really furious attack on workers being organized?
It absolutely is a furious attack, and yet it is also not impossible. I do want to say that there's a group of cablevision workers, for instance, in Brooklyn, New York. They're communications workers, you know, hooking up the cable and internet, this company Cablevision, who, against all odds, won a union election and plugged away for several years and braved being fired repeatedly and just did finally win a union contract. Here in Oregon at Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, my old local, Local 49, a big group of hospital workers just unionized. So it is true that despite all the odds, the old methods can still work and do still work. But we are in a time of tremendous attack on labor. And one of the stories that gives me the most hope in on the big scale and what's going on in the labor movement is what we're seeing in the world of teacher unions. And certainly the Chicago Teachers Union really touched that off and set an example that a number of other teachers around the country now are rallying to. We wrote a book recently about the Chicago Teachers Union and how they organized and got to their giant 2012 strike, which was an amazing thing to see. I mean, from across the country reading the headlines, it gave me a chill because here you have these teachers who took on one of the most powerful men in the country, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, and beat him and rallied the whole city to their side and had tens of thousands of teachers in the streets of Chicago for a week.
And students and community
parents,
people,
right? And
yeah.
2/3 of parents in the city supported them, even though their lives were thrown out of kilter by having their students out of school for a week. People knew that the teachers were on their side.
The same story is in Portland, actually. And the Chicago teachers did provide a model for the whole country.
They really have. They really have. And they did, I think, so many things right. One of the reasons we wanted to write a book about them is because a few years before that, they were sort of an ordinary union with all the ordinary problems of apathy and cynicism and not having done anything in a while and being up against fearsome forces and sort of people feeling hopeless and disorganized. You know, sort of there wasn't anything special about this union, but a few activists started organizing from the bottom up and really did transform it. And I think any union in the country could do what they did and achieve the same result. And part of what they did was good old-fashioned organizing, one-on-one conversations, exactly,
yes.
Like person by person. And part of why I think the teachers have been able to build such strong alliances with parents, with students, with the communities around their school, is that they have expanded the notion of what the union stands for and said, this is about making better schools, which is closest to the heart of teachers and of parents and of students. And they were willing to tell the truth about what is wrong with the situation we're in. I think often public workers in particular feel so boxed in that our whole system is under attack already, so we have to sort of defend the status quo. And the teachers that we talked with for the book talked about how liberating it was to talk honestly with parents about what was wrong with the schools, what they were frustrated with, that they were sure the parents were frustrated with too, about having these overloaded classes, about having too much time spent on tests, and about the racism of the school system there. You know, they were very bold in saying publicly, this is a system of educational apartheid. This is a city where we have one system for the wealthy white students who can afford to test into these elite schools in the district, and a different system for Black and Latino students whose schools are being closed right and left, and they're being shunted off into other schools, and whose schools are underfunded and systematically don't even have air conditioning in the summer in Chicago or heat in the winter. And so I do think that like telling those truths, there are a lot of truths like that that labor could say more vocally. We at the post office don't like it either that we're so understaffed and you have to wait in a long line. And across the board, they're cutting our transit service. They're cutting back staffing in our healthcare system. These are things that matter to the public and to the workers, and we've got to fight on them together.
Yeah, social unionism is part of it. You wrote a wonderful article, Fanning the Flames, with Jane Slaughter, and you concluded with saying, you know, there's no substitute. What underlies it all is challenging in the workplace. People have to be organized in the workplace, have one another's backs, recognize the boss wants to squeeze you further and further. They're all in competition. Every one of them thinks that they could go out of business unless they squeeze their workers more. it's quite insidious now, the way the system works, particularly when labor unions are in trouble defending and so few people are organized. Tell us about the importance of the workplace. That's what you're doing, is building activists for the workplace.
Yeah, and that's the principle of the importance of the workplace is something that Labor Notes has always stood for proudly. And I think we do have to be careful at this moment, at the same time as we're lifting up aligning with the community and taking on bigger social issues and saying labor should not constrain itself to narrow interests, which I think are absolutely right and vital. It shouldn't be either or. We shouldn't renounce the workplace and the concerns of the workplace. And I worry sometimes when I hear labor leaders who seem to be sort of giving that up and saying the idea of power at work is dead. We're going to focus on making these alliances or passing these bills. It is still true, both that workers have an intrinsic power at work. We have the power to stop doing the labor that we do, on which capital depends. And it's a power we shouldn't give up. It's also where we spend so many hours of our life. And so many of us at work have very little autonomy and very little sort of dignity in the conditions of our work. And I do think that the way that you build any larger movement has to rest on the tiniest level of people making connections with one another and experiencing power, building power, being able to change something that matters. You don't start with an electoral campaign. You start, well, maybe some people do, but the supervisor who is bullying you, the speed up that is interfering with your brakes or causing you pain, like those things shape our lives, and we have to be able to fight against them.
And in the fight, we also not only become empowered, but what that means is not just waving flags. It means becoming empowered means being able to name the force that creates all of these pressures on people, financial pressures, social pressures, being able to name it and talk about it and talk about alternatives to it and do it democratically. Workplace organizations are not one leader just telling people what to do. Workplace organizations are democratic places, and we really have to promote the power that comes with feeling yourself a capable person in shaping a struggle.
Yes, yes. And when we talk about our unions having an organizing model, we have to not just mean turning on a tap of, you know, show up the workers here and then turn them off again when you've won the campaign.
Send a professional to the place and get them to organize. Organizing has to be...
It has to be owned by the people whose union it is. That's part of what Labor Notes has always stood for and why we do these conferences, for people to meet other rank and filers from other unions and teach each other skills and get inspired and to make thinking strategically not just something that's done by people at the top of the union, but something that's being done all the time by people in every rank and file of the union.
Al Bradbury, keep up the good work. Keep writing great songs. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Bill. Great to be here.
All the union ladies, all the union ladies. 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 Now throw your cards up. Up in the job, trying to hold up. I'm doing my own little thing. Boss is a jerk and I'm doing all the work. My sister worker approaches me. She's tired of being screwed. She says she's through. She said, let's start a union. I said, sounds nice, like good advice. Now we got some organizing to do. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. Don't you worry about your boss and what he say about it. Cause if you like it, then you should sign a card on it.
cards up. Oh, oh, oh.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The music we just heard was fellow worker Haley, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, with her version of Beyoncé's Single Girls, parodied in that old wobbly tradition. Before that, Bill Resnick was talking with Al Bradbury, a former KBOO Labor Radio host and now an editor of Labor Notes. They were discussing some of the new exciting developments in the labor movement and how Labor Notes is covering that. And Al Bradbury even had her own version of Single Ladies with a labor twist. And now we turn to book mole Larry Bolden, who reviews Ursula Heggie's novel Intrusions, which looks at the way that a novel within a novel starts to intrude in the novelist's life as it confronts her with her conflicted identity as an artist and a mother.
Good morning. Like many writers and authors before her, Ursula Heggie wonders whether a woman can be both a good mother and a good writer. In her 1981 novel, Intrusions, she spends an entire novel examining this question, and though she finds many women who say you must choose between your art and your children, she disagrees. Quoting from the book, "You can't have both. You must make a choice." I don't want to believe that. It's too easy a solution, an excuse for anyone who doesn't want to try. I don't want to make that choice. I want both, damn it, I do. Close quote. Given that she published 7 novels, 2 collections of short stories, as well as children's literature and nonfiction books, we must conclude that she has succeeded in doing both. Intrusions, her first published novel, came out in 1981, and there's been a steady stream of work since. This novel's about a writer who not only has to live with the intrusions of 2 small children and her husband, but eventually with the intrusions of the characters in her novel as well. The book skips back and forth between the story of Megan Stone, writing madly whenever she can rest a few minutes from her busy day, and the author herself, who, like her heroine, has a husband and 2 children. The idea of a novel within a novel is not a new one, but Heggie's so clever in the ways in which she argues with her own lead character, Megan, and with Megan's husband, Nick. Heggie deals with intrusions on so many levels. Megan says that were she to be asked by a reporter to define what was most important to her, quote, Megan would quite likely have replied solitude, to be completely alone without even the slightest possibility of an interruption, without even the slightest possibility of the possibility of an interruption. And continuing, she says, this was the year when Megan's children were 2 and 4, when she was always felt surrounded by their needs, even when she was not with them, which was very seldom, when 90% of her conversations hovered on the level of a 2 or 4-year-old, when she began to doubt if she had ever possessed any intelligence, and if so, worried that it was evaporating like fumes from an open can of cleaning fluid, close quote. And when she does find a few moments to write, she feels guilty over what she perceives as neglect of her children. Having lost both of her parents and her brother at the age of 6, killed in a plane crash, and raised by an aunt who is both prudishly strict and quite distant and cold, Megan is intent on being really there for her children, and yet she also feels compelled to write. Every stolen moment of writing brings guilt in its wake, and yet she must write. Megan says she can feel the silent presence of her son just outside her study door, his very silence a weight she can hardly bear. And then even the characters in her novel begin to intrude, questioning her motives, her love of her husband and children. Quote, the characters have moved in. They follow me around, even crowd my family at the dinner table. There isn't room enough for all of us. I can barely move. Nobody but me is aware of them. Close quote. While the problems raised and faced by both Megan and the author herself are serious and heart-wrenching, Heggie displays the dilemmas with a humor and lightness of hand that makes the novel easy and fun to read. I started this novel many years ago, right after reading Heggie's most famous novel, Stones from the River, but adhering to my own conviction that readers ought not stick with books that do not thoroughly engage them, I let Intrusions fall to the side. I was surprised when I recently picked up the novel again, searching my started but not finished bookshelf, and found that I had read 200 pages of this 270-page novel before moving on to other things. This time, I breezed through the novel in just a day or two, and was so intrigued that it was hard to understand why I had given up on it earlier. No matter. Such things have happened to me before. But I remain committed to finishing only books that hold my attention throughout. Too many good books to do otherwise. What I think Hedgy shows her readers in this novel is that one can be both a good, committed artist and a good parent, and the relationships between men and women can be good despite sometimes requiring balancing acts. Speaking of her book club, Megan says, quote, "But the fiction we discuss tells us that to be a woman is to be a victim, that all men are villains. Why? It doesn't have to be that way. There are good relationships between men and women, between men and their children, aren't there? I won't let you be victimized by your husband, your children, your house, Megan. I won't let you keep a card file of rooms to be cleaned and silver to be polished." Close quote. I found this book to be wonderfully insightful and humorous, and Hedgy has in her own life shown clearly that women need not decide between their art and their families. They can have both. I've been talking about Ursula Hedgy's novel, Intrusions. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a jaybird in the spring. I wish I was a jaybird in the spring. If I was a jaybird in the spring, no woman hear me sing. Lord, I wish I was a jaybird in the spring. Yeah. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms. If I was a baby in mama's arms, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arms.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement. The music we just heard was a little bit more of Blind Boy Paxton in his version of Mole on the Ground, which we also heard at the beginning of the show. And before that, Larry Bolden was reviewing Ursula Hegge's book, Intrusions. Up next, Todd Sloan talks with Laura Messersmith-Glavin of the Institute for Anarchist Studies about the complex relationship between theory and social practice. Now, by theory, they mean social or political or cultural theory, theories of power, agency, and subjectivity, Marxist theory, for example, or feminist theory or queer theory. And by social practice, they mean activism on the one hand, but also how we interact with people in a more mundane way and how our individual life activity is itself social in many ways.
This is Todd Sloan with the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm sitting with Laura Messersmith-Glavin, who is a developmental reading and writing instructor at Portland Community College and also a member of the board of the Institute for Anarchist Studies and a member of the editorial collective of the journal for the Institute for Anarchist Studies. We've been talking off and on over the years about the question of how does complicated political and social theory get connected to the actual practice of grassroots organizing. Lots of people get into concepts from great theorists like Gramsci, hegemony, Marx's theory of surplus value, Foucault's power-knowledge relation, all sorts of sort of academic-type concepts that do illuminate things. But often, at least in my own practice, I've had a hard time seeing how some of those things directly apply as I'm sitting in meetings and grassroots political organizing groups and finding how would they apply to anything that we're doing. So Laura has been doing a lot of that sort of organizing, also working in publishing journals that do connect the theory and practice. So that's the topic for today. So I'm curious, how do you begin to think about this question of theory in relation to practice? And
You're right in that often the ideas that drive the work and the work itself are operating in totally different spheres, right? People get activated through different means. Sometimes they are engaged in maybe single issue struggles around things that are close to their life, close to their experiences, and then as they grow as activists and as organizers, then they start seeking out theory that helps them explain and see the work that they're doing in a larger systemic fashion. And then you have people who come to these political ideas strictly through theory, you know, through generally through academics, like you said. And the problem is that those two things are often crafted in isolation from one another. So then the theory that is driving a lot of the work or that informs a lot of the work is often being crafted in isolation and then received or reapplied in a context that's totally unlike the one in which it was originally developed. One of the problems with theory being an academic pursuit as well is then it starts to serve as a gatekeeping device within the activist community itself, where you have, you know, the have-reads and the have-nots. And often the theory is crafted or delivered in this kind of language that can be very inaccessible to those who have not had access to an advanced degree. You know, and I think the principles of justice and any kind of foundations of an egalitarian society, I think those principles should be pretty simple, right? Should mm-hmm. be pretty clear. They shouldn't require a master's degree in social theory to understand.
Sure, so the social theory ends up silencing lots of people in those contexts where people are trotting out those ideas.
Precisely, and it is often not the same people that are doing the work or that are directly influenced by the issues at hand that are doing the developing of the theory itself. And that also replicates certain patterns of oppression that we're working against.
Mm-hmm. So why bother then with the theory? I haven't heard lots of good reasons for moving back and forth between the two levels. Some people come in through theory mm-hmm. toward, then they figure out, oh man, I got to work on social justice stuff because I've studied sociology or something. Mm-hmm. And then others coming from the actual more direct experiences of suffering and exploitation and so forth.
Right.
And understanding at a basic level without intellectualizing, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, from my perspective, the theory should always be grounded in the work itself and in the lived experiences of the people that it is intended to empower, that it's intended to support. I know that there's a critique of that position from the Marxist perspective, the idea that lived experience is insufficient to explain the systems that oppress us, that if that were the case, that we would have overthrown capitalism already if it were so apparent what the problems were, right? But to me, that's not really the question. The question, I don't assume that there's some kind of magical counter-hegemonic thinking that everyone will just wake up and be like, ooh, I'm oppressed and let's overthrow this because it's clearly unsustainable, right? But I do think that the theory that is most useful and the theory that is going to be the most dynamic and guide us towards finding new ways of building society is going to be grounded directly in the lived experiences of the people. Right, that they will see in their own lives reflections of these ideas, and then those ideas themselves will then be reshaped to reflect the experiences that they're having, based upon trial and error on the ground through their organizing work and through their other experiences. And you know, there are plenty of aspects of theory that are just completely transformative, even on a daily basis. I mean, even for myself speaking as an anarchist, there are many principles from Marx, for instance, that have helped me understand economics in ways that I never had access to before. Even just the basic idea of what is surplus value, right? And just the concept of exploitation and understanding what it really means to be alienated from one's labor, right? So, you know, if Marx teaches us that's the concept of extraction, right? That there is an owner and there is a laborer, and that the laborer is not paid the full value of their work. Mm-hmm. And the difference between that becomes profit, and that distance also then is known as, you know, alienation on the part of the laborer, the distance from their work and the value of their work. But that alienation, the use of that word alienation, for me, when I look at the alienation in my own life, when I have to work, you know, 40, sometimes 50, sometimes more hours a week, I see that alienation in really concrete terms for me. It's alienation from my partner. It's alienation from other things that I would like to be doing with my life, creative work, organizing work, political work, being with family and friends. It's alienation from my child. I have to pay someone else to take care of him because I'm too busy working in order to pay for these other things, right? So we get caught up in the system. And so it's the theory that helps me understand that and then extrapolate to larger aspects of the system I'm involved with.
Just a good example of a concept that pretty complicated, but as you begin to look where is it happening in your life, it illuminates some things that you might not have attended to
right.
otherwise, aspects of alienation. So
and helps me it gives me a sense of control as well. Like I'm able to put a name to the thing. I'm able to understand the processes at work. Otherwise, it's easy to get overwhelmed, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that feeling of despair is fundamentally paralyzing. And so the better we're able to understand those systems, the better able we are to act against them.
Mm-hmm. So can you go the other direction? Are there things that in your own organizing practice that you've found yourself really needing a concept or mm-hmm. wishing you could understand something more complexly and then finding it in theory?
Well, I can think of examples when I think lived experience has translated to better, stronger, like more accurate theory. Mm. So, for instance, I think of the work that, in particular, queer women of color have done to act as a corrective against sort of the single, like the one-dimensional aspects of feminism that have come from white feminists, often from middle-class white feminists. Whereas, you know, working class or impoverished, you know, queer women of color have taught us a lot about the ways in which oppressions will intersect. And so that notion of intersectionality, that it's actually a great privilege to be able to think of many issues as single issue things, right? That, you know, for many, many people, when they engage in work or when they enter into any conversation, it's not like they're thinking, oh, well, this is happening because I'm a woman or this is difficult because I'm queer. It's like they're all of these things all of the time. And so they're understanding how different oppressions, different layers operate and interact with one another. And that, for me, has helped me understand much better, you know, the nature of the way that power moves, the nature of the way in which different oppressions interact, mm-hmm. right? The way these things are connected, too.
And you wouldn't necessarily need the concept like intersectionality in order to realize that. You would be probably exactly. come from experience directly.
Exactly. Well, and learning from the experiences of others. I mean, more practically, too, like I can give an example of I have been a part of a climate collective that grew out of a study group where we basically were trying to study ourselves out of that feeling of despair that comes from feeling like we're just totally doomed in terms of climate catastrophe, seeing things happening all over the world. And so we just started studying, you know, based on the premise, okay, well, if climate change has an anthropogenic source, if it comes from human activity, perhaps there are human solutions. And we read and we read and we read and we read and we talked and we read and we found a way through it where it started to lead to, okay, there are real and practical solutions to this. And then we thought, great, we need to share this. We developed a curriculum and we started meeting with other kinds of activist groups, engaging in dialogue around, okay, how do, for instance, issues like policing, how do issues like immigration, how do issues like food security, how do these all intersect with climate so we can all have these conversations together? And then we ended up doing a working with a couple of other groups, Rising Tide and Hello 503, we did a canvas up in an area of you know, the Portland metro area up in St. John's, where the coal trains were planned to be moving through, and we figured that was a neighborhood that was most likely to be impacted by the coal trains, and so we thought, well, let's find out what that neighborhood thinks. Mm-hmm. Right? And so we did a canvas, and we asked about attitudes, about climate, about coal, about the trains, about direct action, about different kinds of activism, just to learn, you know, what's going on there. And we were amazed at the response that we got. Not only was there a tremendous amount of concern around climate change, but there was a tremendous amount of popular support, almost consent, like almost unanimously. People said that they were in favor of civil disobedience, illegal action, direct action, as long as no one got hurt. And that was interesting to learn, right? Mm-hmm. We then tried to organize some study groups, though, based on that principle, and discovered that that did not get the same kind of response. Mm-hmm. So that corrective to us was that the community comes first before what we thought of as like the necessary educational components, right? And that was important for us to learn as well.
That's a great example. So we need to wind this down, but is there, as you think about this general question of theory in relation to practice, is there some kind of summary or motto that you keep in mind about it, or some last suggestion you have for people listening?
Well, I think that the people doing the work need to be the ones generating the ideas. Those are the voices that we need to hear the most. That's where the most dynamic and vibrant concepts come from. And, you know, I work with the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and one of the things we try to do is to provide material resources for those voices to be heard. So we offer grants for people specifically who do not have access to academic funding, we want to give people the time and the space to think about the meaning of their work and how it contributes to a larger vision for a free society. We also want to publish marginal voices either in our journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory or on our website. We also have a book series that we do in conjunction with AK Press. So, you know, together we're trying to complete the ideas of anarchism and help develop a more robust and complete theory that comes from the bottom up.
Great.
First time I have read the Bible, it had struck me as unwitty. I think it may start a rumor that the Lord ain't got no humor. Put me inside SSC. Where's this super string theory? Aye, 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 aye. Accelerate the protons. I steer it twice and then just admit, 'cause I don't read.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The music we were just listening to was Super Theory of Super Everything by Gogol Bordello. Before that, Todd Sloan was talking with Laura Messersmith-Glavin about the relationship between theory and social practice. Well, to wrap up today's show, I'm joined with Cassie Thornton, a visiting artist from the Bay Area who came to Portland recently. She's leaving today to present some artwork that she has put together on debt. Thanks for joining us, Cassie.
Thanks, Joe.
So could you tell us a little bit about what you came up to Portland to present and about how debt has made its way into your artwork?
Well, I came up to do a workshop with the PSU Social Practice Program, as well as to do a lecture as a part of Assembly, which is a social practice conference. And then finally, to release a book with Recess PDX about debt. And last night we did that at Mother Foucault's, and I gave a little performance slash lecture about it. I've been making work about debt with actually debt as my creative material for a bunch of years, since actually around 2008. The first project I ever did was actually collecting receipts on Wall Street in front of Walgreens from people that were probably working on Wall Street. And I'd collect their receipts and ask them if they understood what debt was, because I was actually just curious. And then I'd paper mache them together to make little rocks. And then I made those rocks into jewelry so that bankers could wear the debt around their neck. But that never really happened. A banker never really wore the jewelry I made around their neck, but I did sell it for a lot of money that supported me.
What did that materialization represent in terms of making that idea more accessible?
Well, for me, debt was so abstract. In 2008, I was living in New York, and I had always been poor, and I'd been working in the public school system. And during the financial crash, I remember feeling like I had no idea what anyone was talking about when they said debt. So, meanwhile, my mother's house had been foreclosed, and she had claimed bankruptcy, and it was about the same time, and I just really needed to make debt physical, like something that you could hold, or something, ideally, that you could throw at someone, because it was something that created a lot of pain for me and for a lot of the people that I knew, though I really didn't understand it, and there was really no research available about it. At least it was easily accessible at that time.
I think it's really interesting the way that you choose to kind of metallicize it, because that's exactly what happens when we stamp bullion money with this IOU, basically, from the state.
When I metallicize it, like the cast debt, right? So yeah, I mean, it's interesting because just the way that there's a discrepancy between, like, the value of currency and the, like, this is abstract also, but, you know, the nickel might be worth 8 cents in materials, but it's actually, we use it for 5 cents, or that's probably more like the penny. But I have been making these physical pieces of art that are representative of debt, and this book that I wrote is very much about whether that physical thing that I made is more valuable as debt or more valuable as art. So when I made these little rocks to represent my debt, I could sell them for, you know, a few thousand dollars as art, but I don't know. I mean, their value is so abstract, just like the value of debt or the sort of power of debt is so abstract.
I went to both of your lecture and then your performative lecture at Mother Foucault's. And on Thursday, when you were speaking at PSU, you described a debt visualization kind of project that you involved some people in. Could you speak a bit about that and how people visualize their debts?
Yeah. Since I was in grad school in 2010, I began to invite people to tell me about their debt. And most people are not willing to talk about their debt, so I found some other ways to get around that. And one way was to have people tell me what their debt would look like if it was a physical object. So in grad school, I was going to get my MFA in fine art, so people were pretty open to talking about things that were so abstract and visual like this. People would say, like, oh, my debt looks like a big metallic ball that follows me wherever I go. It's in the periphery of my vision, but when I look at it, it disappears. And things like that led me to design a process where I invited people specifically to think about their debt in like a hypnotherapeutic process and describe it as a physical object. And what this does is it opens people up to the idea of talking about their debt at all and maybe even sharing how much debt they're in, and possibly for the first time. So what I do with debt visualizations is I invite people to close their eyes and imagine themselves in search of something unknown. Maybe it's in a, like, it, the context change, but maybe I'll have you be in a familiar outdoor area, and I'll ask you to be in search of a physical form of your debt, and I lead you through it and ask you lots of questions. And a lot of people see similar stuff. So some people see their debt as fog that they try to move, but they can't. They can't really get their hands around it. They can't contain it. But it's blocking their vision. Or some people see their debt as like a huge metallic object coming from the center of the earth that's like poisoning all the soil. And they'll even acknowledge like that it's not an unnatural form, but that it's so scary and precarious and they don't know what would get rid of it. And then, you know, a lot of people see things like fungus that are that's growing all over, you know, their environment, and they can't seem to get rid of it. But I think the interesting part of this process is that there's some tropes to how people see their debt. And so I'm starting to get a pretty strong understanding of like what debt does to the unconscious. And so I can not only talk to individuals about this, but I can use this information about how debt affects people for political means. I can write letters and dictate to people who, you know, perhaps somebody like the president of my art school. I did this. I wrote a letter and said, described what supposedly radical art students are, you know, seeing because of, as a byproduct of their indebtedness.
Before we wrap up, could you tell listeners how to follow your work?
Yeah, my website is CassieThornton.com. You can find in Portland at Mother Foucault's my new book called Rock, which is about debt, the unconscious, and sort of value in a personal narrative. And at my website, you can look up the Strike Debt Bay Area radio episodes that we've made for KPFA, which sort of summarize issues around debt in really sort of short, concise episodes. And I think most importantly, I just want to emphasize that Strike Debt is an amazing and growing organization that I work with, and it's national. And we are working with Debt Collective to create a debt strike. So if you go to debtcollective.org, you can learn about the Corinthian 15 and how you can support debt strike that is really meaningful against the Department of Education. So that's debtcollective.org.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Cassie Thornton.
Thank you.
Life in debt. Light a cigarette, smoke the stress, take a deep breath, baby, let's rearrange the mess we've inherited. Alienated from what is rightfully yours and mine. Land is life, money is time, paid for labor. Working 8 to 5, sometimes 6, 7 to 8. We come home and barely know the neighbors. Bills are usually late. Interest accumulates at a usury rate. Collection agency waits from paycheck to next one. Budget like a noose. Working while we sing the proletariat blues on 501c3 community plantations. Nonprofit sector propped up to kill the movement for the changes in production relations. But woman, you're my comrade, ride or die, revolutioning in Mother Earth, standing with me in the grocery line, while I'm paying with a jar of pennies, nickels, and dimes. I love how you don't like art without a message. I love it how you call some fellas on they fetish. Third world system, never sacrificing substance for style, but stylish with a golden type smile. I love it how you organize with other strong sisters. Love it how you talk about tearing down the system like a soldier. My dialectical reflection, yes, is the answer to your question. Life in debt, write another check to the landlord. No time to dwell on all the things we can't afford. Got a baby in the womb, a soldier for the future that we're fighting for. Concrete conditions that are ripening for. The payback is way past due. And they say that the masses ain't ready, but we know that ain't true. You and I, both children of Filipino immigrants from the same island. Our ancestors smiling, cause we found one another in a strange land struggling. Mom's trying to tell us not to protest, instead pray for peace. But that ain't the nature of the beast. So lady, grab the bullhorn and take it to the streets. Yelling power to the people. El pueblo unido, jamás será vencido. Till the wealth is spread equal, you 21st century Gabriela Salong. Fierce like Lorena with a rifle in her arm. And I love how you love the people as much as self. I love it how you want redistribution of the wealth. Third world system, never sacrificing substance for style, but stylish with a golden type smile. I love it how you organize with other strong sisters. Love it how you talk about tearing down the system like a soldier. My dialectical reflection, yes, is the answer to your question. Life and death.
I like making you so happy. I like making you so happy. I like making you so happy. Cause making you so happy makes me happy too. Making you so happy makes me happy too.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Al Bradbury for starting off the hour talking about how Labor Notes is putting the movement back in the labor movement, to Larry Bolden for his review of Ursula Heggie's Intrusions, to Todd Sloan and Laura Messersmith-Glavin for talking about the complex relation between theory and social practice, and again to Cassie Thornton for talking about her artwork and about how people are trying to channel their feelings about debt. You can find a recording of The Old Mole in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We post the whole show in individual segments with links to related or mentioned materials. You can also find The Old Mole at facebook.com/Old Mole or Twitter at twitter.com/Old Mole, where we post our updates about when the show has been put on the website. So tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from The Mole's radical perspective. Well, coming up next, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we're going to hear Between the Lines, a progressive weekly news magazine. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Janet Larson, author of the new book from the Earth Policy Institute titled The Great Transition, about moving away from fossil fuels. At 11, we'll hear Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is renowned herbalist Rosemary Gladstar, author of the book Herbs for Children's Health. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio with host Will Hall, who brings us voices and visions from outside mental health.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Arresting Power, chronicling police violence in Portland. Arresting Power was screened at the Clinton Street Theater on Friday, June 5th at 7 p.m., Saturday, June 6th at 7 p.m., and Sunday, June 7th at 3 o'clock p.m. Arresting Power provides memorial and testimony from some victims of police violence and analysis of the role of the police in the United States. On Sunday, June 7th at 4:30 p.m., there will be a panel discussion entitled Building Resistance, which will explore the diversity of tactics and ideologies in the fight against police brutality and social control. Again, that's Arresting Power at June 5th and 6th at 7 p.m. and Sunday, June 7th at 3 p.m., followed by discussion at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
And it is a half a minute past 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and